Well, thanks to Mike. Oh, guess I am online. Mike and Anna for organizing this conference and for inviting me to speak first thing on the first day. It's always fun. So what I'm going to tell you about is mostly joint work with Sarah Billy, and we call it. So it's affine dual equivalence, and I'll explain all of these words, except maybe the last one, which you should already know. So this is joint with Sarah Billy, who unfortunately couldn't make it. But so what I'm going to do is I'm going to review a lot of the stuff that you probably saw last week in terms of the combinatorics of K-sure functions. I'll try to go over that somewhat quickly so I don't bore those of you who were here last week. But since I wasn't here last week, I won't hold it against you if you weren't. So I will try to define everything. And this podium doesn't block this board, does it? A little bit? Okay, well then I won't write too much on this board. All right, let me start by telling you sort of what the main setup is. So affine dual equivalence is a special case of a general method that I've been working on to sort of establish sure positivity of a symmetric function if you know its quasi-symmetric expansion. So this is sort of the most interesting example of this method, so it's sort of perfect for this conference, because it tells us that K-sure functions are sure positive. But let me first explain to you sort of how the method goes. So you start with a function f, and we don't know much about the function. The only thing that we're going to know is that it can be written as a sum over some objects, which I'll just abbreviate like that. And in turn, it's written in terms of quasi-symmetric functions. So we'll put a capital X, right? X is a finite or infinite set of variables. We don't know that F is symmetric, but ultimately we hope that it is. And sigma is going to be a map from some set of objects. This is just some set of objects, combinatorial objects. Think of tableau if you have nothing better to think of, or strong tableau if you're feeling ambitious. And you can think of sigma as just, it's given us a descent set associated with these objects. A descent set, which would be a subset of M, which I'm going to think of as an indicator function. So I'm just going to think of it as a sequence of pluses and minuses saying I'm in the descent set or I'm not. And I'll make this more concrete with some examples coming up. So the idea is we have a function like this. For example, K-sure functions, right? Are a sum over starred strong tableau, some extra statistic that'll pop up when it needed, of these quasi-symmetric functions. And here, this is just the inverse descent set of the reading word. Now, I'll write that on the board when I actually get to K-sure functions, but just to sort of motivate this sort of framework. So again, the idea is I have this function f. All I know is it's quasi-symmetric. This is Gödel's fundamental quasi-symmetric function. I could throw up a definition of it. You really don't need to know a definition of it for this talk, but for those who can't really concentrate unless I tell you the definition, if I give you some subset like this or some indicator function like this, this guy is just a sum of I1 and equal to Im, and you have equality, so ij is equal to ij plus 1, only if, let's see, I think it's j is in there, yeah. So sigma j is equal to plus 1. And you take x, I1, x, I, j. So a quasi-symmetric function is a sum of monomials. And basically what you do is you're specifying when you have to have a strict increase of index. Otherwise, the indices can be whatever you like. You can sort of span them out. This is Gödel's fundamental basis for quasi-symmetric functions. So from the definition or from the name, you can tell they're sort of important. These boards are kind of heavy. Right, so the idea is that we hope that f is symmetric, and whenever we have a symmetric function, we really hope that it's sure positive. So really what we want to understand is if we take f and we write it as a sum, if it's symmetric, we can write it as a sum of sure functions, and we'll call the coefficients that we get maybe capital F lambda. And these are what we really want to understand, and for example, we want to know, are they numbers? Right, that would tell us that they're incredibly, really combinatorial. And if they're numbers, of course, we want to know what's a nice combinatorial formula for those numbers. That's the general problem. And so the solution is the following. So if... Oh, I'm good at breaking talks to me. So if there exists a dual equivalence model for these objects and the associated function sigma, they're sort of these two bits of data. So you need the objects in order to get a function out of it, you need the sigma, so we'll tie those guys together. So if there's a dual equivalence model, and I'll define what I mean by that, probably towards the end of the talk, then for T in object fixed, we have that the sum over everything in T's dual equivalence class, right? There's a dual equivalence model, which means there's some equivalence relation I'm putting on my objects. If I fix an object, I look at everything in its dual equivalence class, and I sum over that Q sigma of S. So I'm just summing over some of the terms that come up in S. Then this guy, well, if it's a really good dual equivalence model, it'll be a single sure function, but in general, this thing is sure positive. So it's actually, that just means that it's a sum over some lambda of, well, gosh, I'm running out of letters. I've already used capital F. I guess G is next. I don't really use G. We'll go back to E. E lambda, F lambda, or some E lambda, N. So it's a sum of some symmetric functions, and there's a special case when you get one here. So it's actually just equal to a single sure function. And so in particular, F lambda is a number, and it's actually equal to the number of dual equivalence classes with, it's a little low. All right. In particular, this guy is a number. And I can tell you what number. It's the number of certain equivalence classes. Equivalence classes that have a certain shape. So that's the sort of general overview of what the problem is we want to solve and sort of how we're going to solve it without giving you any details of what anything means. It's sort of all hidden in this definition. So now let's talk about the functions that we care about a lot, especially for this conference. Well, first of all, I guess the functions we should all care most about are the sure functions. So sure functions are actually going to fit in this model because sure functions are sure positives. So we'll denote those. So I guess right now I'm just trying to fix some notation, just remind you of the basic objects. Here are sure functions. What are the combinatorics associated with sure functions? So what I want to know is, what are these objects here? Well, the objects here are going to be standard Young tableau. So we take the numbers 1 through, we use the letter N. No, so we'll use the letter M. So we take the numbers 1 through M. We're going to fill them into boxes. This is shape lambda. These are called standard Young tableau of shape lambda. I'll do some examples of these guys in a minute. But these are the combinatorial objects that sure functions are the generating function for in this sense. There's a reading word associated to it. So we have a reading word. So a reading word is going to be a permutation. And from that, so sigma of a tableau S is equal to the inverse descent set of the reading word of S. And again, I'll do some examples, but that's just the descent set of the inverse permutation, if you like. And what's the other thing? Left space for a reason. Oh, so what's dual equivalence in this setting? So as I said, it sort of needs to be some sort of equivalence relation. So I'll just tell you on the level of reading words, because there's a one-to-one correspondence between tableau and the reading words, right, if I tell you the shape. So this is due to Heyman. He defined dual equivalence, which is basically saying that if your reading word looks like 213, then it's equivalent to something with a reading word that looks like 312. And 231 is equivalent to 132, and this is due to Haman in a paper in 92. So Haman introduced the idea of dual equivalence on Tableau and on shifted Tableau in order to resolve some conjectures of Proctor. He called it dual equivalence because it's exactly dual to Jitta Takan, or if you like to think of it in terms of permutations, it's dual to Knuth equivalence. Knuth equivalence involves looking at three consecutive letters and telling which one's in the middle and switching the other two. This is the same thing, only you can think of it as acting on positions instead of on the letters. So it's dual, it's on happening on the inverse. Okay, so that's sure functions on the combinatorics there. K-sure functions. So I should specify that throughout my talk, I'm making a global constant, the n is k plus 1. Sometimes I'll say k and sometimes I'll say n, and this is their relationship. So K-sure functions, and I may as well start now, you take an n core, you put a little k to remind you that that's an n core, and K-sure functions have this extra parameter t, and the combinatorics here I'm going to screw that one up, so let's just do this guy. So this is an example of a three-core. So these are going to be equals an n-core. So take an n-core partition, and you're going to fill it, you're going to sort of fill it with numbers. Let me not write that. Let me just put starred strong tableau of shape new and put an n there. So these are the objects that Jennifer Morris and probably other people talked about last week. So you have these objects called starred strong tableau, and you also have a reading word. And the reading word, just as with symmetric functions, just as with sure functions, will give you this sigma function if you just take the inverse descent set. It's a very special reading word that you need to take for what I want. It may turn out that you can use a more general reading word, but I have a specific one in mind that I need to use here. And it turns out that dual equivalence in this case, what I'm going to write down is sort of a lie, but I can make it less or more honest in a little while. So what you do is the same sort of thing. You can do Haman's dual equivalence on the reading word. One problem with this, well, there are two problems with this. So the first problem with this, right, is that it's not well defined. Because here you have a bijection with the reading word, so if I do something to the reading word, I can do the corresponding thing to the tableau, and that's well defined. Here, it's not well defined. There are starred strong tableau of the same shape with the same reading word that are actually different. So it's not well defined just to tell you what I'm doing on the reading word. It is well defined for giving you the sigma function, but that's about it. So this doesn't tell me exactly what dual equivalence is, but it sort of gives me an idea of what I should be aiming for. And the other problem with this is even if you sort that mess out, it doesn't work. You need to add another thing. So the other thing is, and hopefully you can read this from here. You could make these two guys equivalent and these two guys equivalent, or you could just switch these two. And then you could say, well, here's the equivalence relation. It's different. And it turns out that that's what you need to do. Sometimes you do this. Sometimes you do that. I'll have to be precise as to when you do which, and I also have to be precise as in what that means in terms of the tableau. So it's sort of an analogy, but it's a little more subtle. And this is joint work with Sarah Billy recently. So that's sort of the idea, and I guess I'll mention, because I left enough space, right, K-sure functions came up in terms of McDonald polynomials. So it was conjectured that McDonald polynomials were sure positive, and that's since been proven, I think, three times. But the K-sure functions originally, right, Jennifer Morris, Luc Lepont, and Alain Lescaut originally defined them because they noticed that, hey, they're a really nice basis that sort of lives in between. So they conjectured McDonald polynomials are K-sure positive, and K-sure functions are sure positive. And it gave you a really nice way of sort of getting that in stages. Right, so what Sarah, Billy, and I do, we prove this direction of sure positivity, that we get K-sure functions are sure positive. Work that I did using the same method proved that McDonald polynomials are sure positive. And the parallels between these two methods, we're hoping will maybe give us this. And this is something that Sarah, Billy, and I are working on. And not really too important. So McDonald polynomials, just for those of you who haven't seen them, here's a McDonald polynomial. It's got an H. It's indexed by a partition. It's got two extra parameters. You get it by taking a partition, filling it with numbers in any way that you like. There's no condition on increasing or like rows or columns. And so you can just take a permutation to be the reading word. And it turns out that this is the right thing to do for dual equivalence, and that just works. You don't have to worry about any of the subtlety that comes up for K-share functions. It just works. So it's really similar. It's somehow simpler, which is a bit surprising. But it sort of fits into this nice picture. Okay, so now let's start getting our hands dirty and actually defining a lot of these things. All right, even though you already know what a sure function is, I just want to remind you what it is so that I can make a parallel with the K-sure function. So sure functions. Well, as I said, the generating function of standard Young tableau, and I drew standard Young tableau suggestively so that they look like tableau. But really, I don't want to think about a tableau that way. I want to think about it in terms of Young's lattice. So Young's lattice starts with nothing, and then you add boxes, and it's ranked by the number of boxes. So you can have two boxes or two boxes that way. Covering relations in this lattice are just containment of diagrams. So if I draw this level, the containment is like this. And one more level, just because it's kind of interesting. So so containment is like this. So this is Young's lattice. You just keep going up like this. It is a lattice, but for my purposes, I just care that it's a ranked poset, and it has a very special property that will be associated with any Coxeter group, which is that intervals are nice. We'll say a little more about that. So a standard Young tableau of shape lambda is a saturated chain starting with the empty partition, adding a box, and eventually getting lambda. For example, here's a Young tableau of shape 2-2. I'm going to take this saturated chain. One way that you often write if I drew this thing out each time, it would be a bit laborious. So I can actually give a shorthand for this, which is just put numbers in boxes as they're created, starting from the bottom, so there's nothing. Eventually, this is my shape. The first box I added here, then I went here and added a box, and then I added a box up here, and then I added a box up here. There's actually another thing I could have done. For the same shape, I could have gone around this way. And if I went around that way, doing the same thing, what I would get is 1, 3, 2, 4. Like that. Okay, so it's a theorem that using this idea of dual equivalence where you make these local switches, and here 1, 2, and 3 could be I minus 1, I, and I plus 1 for any I. But in this example, they're going to be 1, 2, and 3, or 2, 3, and 4. These guys are actually dual equivalent. Because I can look at the reading word of this guy, which, by the way, is 3, 1, 4, 2. And the reading word of this is 2, 4, 1, 3. Ah, that's a good point. I'm actually neither. It's the diagonal word. So it doesn't matter what you do. You can pick any good reading word. I guess the definition of good is it works, so maybe that's circular. But what I'm doing is I'm reading along diagonals because that's what I want to do for K-sure functions. So here I read the 3, and then I read the 1, and then the 4, and then the 2. So these are my reading words. And now if I look at the word, I look for 1, 2, and 3, the numbers 1, 2, and 3, and I look for And again, I mean, you can add 1 to each of these numbers and look for the same relation. So here's 1, 2, and 3. Here's 1, 2, and 3. And what I've done is I've exactly done Hamann's dual equivalence. This one is the top one up there. I have 3, 1, 2. So 1 is sort of witnessing the switch that's happening, and the switch happens between 2 and 3. In terms of Young's lattice, what I've done is I have a rank 2 interval. And by the way, all rank 2 intervals in Young's lattice are either chains, so they just go straight down, or they're diamonds. And it turns out that when you have dual equivalence, you always get a diamond. And what you're doing is you're doing an interval exchange at that diamond. That's what dual equivalence is on this lattice. So this was the observation of Sarah Billy's that allowed us to extend this whole model to K-Schur functions. Okay, so I think that's all I wanted to say about Schur functions. Oh, well, I guess I should maybe say this, that a Schur function is the sum over all standard Young tableau of a particular shape of Q sigma of T of X. And now, as I said, sigma of T, you just take the descent set of the reading word, I'm sorry, the inverse descent set. So here, what you're going to do is you're going to go through the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on in order. And whenever you go to the left, you get a minus, and when you go to the right, you get a plus. So if I'm doing this guy, from 1 to 2, I go right, that gets me a plus. From 2 to 3, I go left, that gets me a minus. And from 3 to 4, I go right, that gets me a plus. Doing the same thing over here, I get minus, plus, minus. So that's what the sigma function is giving us. And this is just telling me that 2 is in the descent set, and this is telling me that 1 and 3 are in the descent set. Right, the last letter is never in the descent set because it can't be less than something that's not there. So here's a Schur function, and the theorem that's due to Hamann, and again, this is from his 92 paper where he introduced dual equivalence, is that the dual equivalence classes, so DE classes, are exactly the standard Young tableau of a given shape. So in particular, this means that I could write my Schur function as a sum over all tableau that are in the dual equivalence class of my favorite tableau of shape lambda. And I do have a favorite, and I might be able to tell you about my favorite in a little while, of Q sigma of T. So right, this definition and this theorem are pretty much the same. All I've done is replace this set with this, and this is the whole idea of dual equivalence, that I'm doing that. To get Schur positivity, I'm looking at equivalence classes. Every equivalence class is going to be Schur positive. My function obviously breaks up into a union of dual equivalence classes, and since each piece is Schur positive, the whole thing will be. So that's everything that I know about Schur functions. Are there any questions on that? Yeah. Is it obvious? No, but it's not too hard to convince yourself of that. It basically, if you think of dual equivalence as dual to Jitta to Khan, it's easier. I'm thinking about it in terms of permutations because it's easier to do that because doing Jitta to Khan on a board is really hard. Or at least takes a long time. But it's not too hard to see that. I mean, you just go down 2 steps and then you go back up 2 and you end up at the same place, so you kind of had to go around. Does that make sense? I guess. Start with this board. Okay, so what happens when you put the K in front? Okay, so K-Schur functions, as any of you who were here last week, and probably all of you who were here at this conference know, were discovered or invented, whatever your paradigm is, by Alain Lescaut, Luc Leponte, and Jennifer Morse, in alphabetical order. Sorry for getting that wrong. But the definition that I'm going to give you is actually in a paper that is in Memoirs of the AMS by Thomas Lamb, Luc Leponte, Jennifer Morse, and Mark Shimazono. And this is using the, so this is in Memoirs. And this is a great paper for finding a ridiculous amount of stuff about all of the combinatorics of this of these guys, and I'm just going to give you a small sampling of that right now that I need for this theorem. So this is the definition of K-share functions that I'm going to be working with, and it starts with a lattice. Well, actually, no, it doesn't. It starts with a poset, though, which is ranked. And this is going to be the poset you get by looking at n cores. So let me just remind you that an n core new means that no hook length is divisible by or equivalently equal to n. It also means you can't remove ribbons from the outside. Just to remind you what a hook length is, if you look at a cell, you take that cell, the number of cells that are up and to the right, going all the way. That tells you the hook length of a cell. So whenever I talk about n cores and I'm talking about this stuff, you should start thinking, oh, this is the affine symmetric group, and you're totally right. But in any event, what I can do is I can take Young's lattice here, and I can just erase anything that's not an n core. That gives me a poset, right? The induced poset on n cores. It turns out that it's ranked, and that comes from the fact that really what's going on here is the affine symmetric group is at work. So let's do an example. N equals 3 is probably small enough to be interesting and big enough to be interesting. Small enough to be doable and big enough to be interesting. Single box is obviously a 3 core. It's got no hook length bigger than 1, so certainly nothing that 3 is going to divide. The next level also stays intact. No worries there. When we come to the third level, well, this has hook length 3, this has hook length 3, this has hook length 3. It completely gets obliterated. Next level, this has hook length 3. Nothing here has hook length 3. So this guy survives. And similarly, the box, the bottom left corner has hook length 3, so it disappears. And the only other thing that survives is the conjugate, and that's not a coincidence. And so this is what I get for the next level. And again, I'm going by containment. That's the covering relation in Young's lattice, so it's the covering relation here. And just to show you what the next level up looks like, it looks like this, and this, and this, and then containment. Ooh, that's not containment. There's your containment. So the rank function here is easy to see. It's the number of boxes. The rank function here is not the number of boxes. However, there's a very nice bijection in a paper by Lafont and Morse that gives you the bijection between K-bounded partitions, that's where the K and K-share functions is coming from, and N cores, N is K plus 1, and if you use that bijection and you go back, then it is the number of boxes back in the K-bounded partition side. So that's the natural ranking. You just sort of can't see it as well in this picture. It's also, the ranking is also the same as length in Bruha order in the affine symmetric group, but again, it's maybe not trivial to see that in this picture. But anyway, these are the objects. So this is the poset that we're going to be working with. So a strong tableau of shape nu is, not surprisingly, a saturated chain. Chain from the empty core up to nu. So, for example, let's do this guy. So if I want to do this guy, I can go down this way. And again, I want to sort of record that saturated chain in the same way that I did over here. So the saturated chain is going to have this overall shape. And now when you put numbers in boxes, you put the same number in all the boxes that you added at that level. So we added one box. Then we went over here, so we added another box. Then we went up here, we added two boxes. So they both get threes, because we're at the third level. You went up again, and again you added, something's amiss. No, it's right. Sorry, I'm confused. Okay, so now you add two more boxes, and they both get fours. Right? And again, I could have done something different. I could have just gone the easiest way there. And that would give me this guy, which would say, one, here's my second box. Then I add these two boxes, and then I add those two boxes. Okay, so if you're familiar with Tableau and you're not familiar with Strong Tableau and you weren't here last week, this should bother you when I call this a Tableau, because there are two threes vertically stacked, and that's somehow like a violation of everything you know. But that's okay, because we think of them as sort of one ribbon, one piece. And it's actually a theorem in this paper by LLMS that at every step you're adding n translates. So if we think of the ice piece, so when you went up, here's like the third piece and here's the second piece, right? So if you think of the difference, just in terms of the diagram difference, this is all n translates of a given n ribbon, a given ribbon of size less than n. So it turns out, and this is not obvious, and one nice way to figure it out is to think about everything in terms of the affine symmetric group acting on cores and look at it in terms of an abacus model, and then it all becomes, oh yeah, clearly that's what's happening. In terms of this picture, you need a lot of intuition to see it. But what's happening is, at every stage, I'm adding ribbons that are exactly the same. It's sort of silly in this case because each ribbon is a single cell, but these are n translates of each other. So if you go here and you go three boxes away, it's exactly here. So there's a lot of structure. It looks a little bit mysterious here, but there's a lot of structure when you're adding these things together. Okay, but I still can't define a function off this the way that I want, because if I want to get a reading word, I have a problem of, when I'm reading this guy, there are two threes to choose from, but maybe it doesn't matter which one I choose. It turns out it doesn't in this case. Well, okay, maybe it does. But for the fours, well, which four do I take to read? And there are other reasons why you need to do sort of slightly different things. And the slightly different thing that you do is we're going to add some extra combinatorial data, which is we're going to put stars. So a starred strong tableau, again of shape new, is a choice of a connected component for each, I'll stick with that notation that I had, each step I minus one of a strong tableau. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a star in the bottom right corner of the ribbon that I get. So for example, the starred strong tableau of those shapes, here I've got, 1, 3, 3, 4, 4, 2. I can put stars. Well, I have no choice. I'm going to star that one because I don't really have a choice. Same with the two. The three, I don't have a choice. I said choose a connected component. Don't choose a cell. This is one connected component. I have no choice. This is where the star goes. Now for the four, I've got some choice. So I could either star this guy, or I could star his friend, or I could star that guy. Oh, I guess I should put all the other stars. Right? So there are a bunch of choices that hop up, and if I did the other one, there would be four choices. Right, for all the stars. There are two choices for how to star the threes, and there are two choices for how to star the fours. So now I'm in business. Now I can define a reading word, which is going to be the same as before. It's a diagonal reading word, but I only read numbers that have stars. So as I go through here, and I'm reading the diagonals, I hit the four. I don't see this three. It doesn't have a star. But I see this three. I then see this one. I don't see this four because it doesn't have a star. And then I see the two. Over here, I don't see the four, I don't see the three, but I do see this three, I see this one, I see this four, and I see that two. These are the reading words for these guys. So the reading word here, if I just gave you the reading word and told you the shape, you couldn't actually construct the starred strong tableau in general. That's one of the things that makes this a much harder problem than what I was doing here on this level. If I just gave you this reading word, you could just do shin set insertion and get a tableau out of it, right? And that's a bijection, right? Actually, a nice way to think about dual equivalence is it gives you the Q things that have the same Q tableau, permutations of the same Q tableau, and Knuth equivalence is permutations of the same P tableau. Another way to think of that. But in any event, there is a bijection going on here. There's not over here. So the reading word gives me information, but it doesn't give me all the information. But now I can define a k-share function. So sk of nu, and here I'm possibly annoying a few people in the audience because I've completely identified k-bounded partitions and n-cores. But you have to forgive me for that. So nu here is going to be an n-core. So this guy is equal to the sum over all starred strong tableau. I need to remember what n is, right? Because it matters that I think of this as a 3-core instead of as like a 12-core. If I thought of the same shape as a 12-core, this would be rank 6. But as a 3-core, it's rank 4. So it matters how I'm thinking of that partition. So I sum all these guys up. I have t to the spin. I'll tell you what spin is in a second. But this is where our t statistic comes from. And now we throw in our quasi-symmetric function. And the quasi-symmetric function you get from reading this guy off. Same way as before. I just take the pluses and minuses based on whether I go right or left when I read the numbers 1 to 4 in order. 1 to 2 is a plus. 2 to 3 is a minus. 3 to 4 is a minus. Here, 1 to 2 is a plus. 2 to 3 is a minus. 3 to 4 is a plus. In particular, these two guys are actually not dual equivalent. But it's possible that we can't see that yet. Okay, so what's the spin statistic? This is fantastic. So the spin statistic is a little kooky, and I'm going to tell you what it is, and I'll ignore it for a while, and I throw it back in at the end. So what is it? Well, it's a sum over all I. So here I'm thinking this is my I. So the numbers in the boxes, so you take the multiplicity of I. So the number of connected components of the I ribbon. So here the multiplicity of 3 is 1. There's one connected component with 3s, but there are two connected components with 4s. Okay, now you multiply that by the height minus 1. So when I say the height of I, well, you're like, but there are two different 4s. Well, remember, there's a theorem that says those 4s have exactly the same shape. Or if you like, you can always take the guy with the star and take his height, if it makes you happier for now. And then you add to that what I'm going to call the depth of I star. So let's do an example. Depth is the number of guys to your left that have, the number of guys to the left of the starred one. So here, 1 and 2 don't contribute anything. Right? Because the height is 1, so when you subtract 1, it's 0, so this guy disappears. And they don't have any depth because there are no other 1s or 2s to their left. So nothing interesting is going to happen with 1 or 2. 3 and 4 get interesting. So here the 3 has height. There's one connected component, so the multiplicity is 1. So the spin here is going to be 1 times 2 minus 1, right? Because height 2 minus 1. Plus, there's no depth. So this is the contribution of the 3s, just for this guy. And now for the 4s, right, the 4s don't have any height. The height is 1, we subtract 1, so that's going to contribute nothing. So that even though the multiplicity is 2, you're multiplying it by 0, so that's a little less than helpful. But this guy has depth, so this guy will be plus 0. So that will contribute 0, but over here, yeah, well, whatever. I did this one. Over here, the depth would be 1. So this guy would be the same, except that it would be 1 instead of 0 on this part. So the spin of this guy, gosh, see how my addition is 1, and the spin of this guy is 2. Okay, it's just some seemingly bizarre statistic that gives you the right definition. Okay, so now I want to try to tell you what dual equivalence is. All right, so dual equivalence back in Schur functions when everything was nice was just interval exchanges. And it's the same thing over there, almost. So that's sort of what we want to do. But it turns out that there are lots of things to consider. So we want to come up with affine, I guess I didn't have to erase that, affine dual equivalence. Okay, so I want to look at what do these intervals look like. Well, here they always sort of locally juxtapose to this thing, even if they happen further up, they more or less look like this. Over here there are a couple things that can happen. You can have, so what are the intervals? Again, because the affine symmetric group is a Coxeter group, all rank two intervals are either going to be a diamond or a chain. So when they're actually in intervals, you can have three types. You can have disjoint. So, for example, I'm sorry, so these examples, n is equal to 4. So here I have 7, 7, 6, 6. I don't actually want to put in all the other numbers because it'll just obstruct everything. So it turns out that when you do an interval exchange, this is what happens. Sometimes, if you have what's called a disjoint interval, this is what it looks like. There's also the nested one is kind of cute. So maybe I'll write down a budding as well. There are three of them, so here they are. Nested, so I need, let's see, five boxes, three boxes. How did that not work? That worked. Okay, so here I could, for example, have 8, 8, 8, 7, 7, 7. So here the 7s were an honest ribbon. It sort of looks a little funky. And it turns out that when you do an interval exchange, well, the 8s, I'm sorry, the 8s now are going to be the ribbony shape, and the 7s have replaced the 8s. So you didn't just change the 7s and 8s. Here you just changed the 7s and 6s. Here you did not just change the 7s and 8s. This is kind of wacky. But it's exactly what the right thing that happens. And then there's one more case that I'll tell you about that's a budding. Let's see. Which is this shape. Again, it's actually important that what I'm doing is n equals 4. So if you're familiar with these objects, keep that in mind. Here, what if I have a bunch of 5s here and a 6 right here? It seems like these guys are totally separate, so it seems like I'm more like in this abutting case, or sorry, in this disjoint case, but it turns out that this 6 is really kind of secretly wanting to be here too. And I'll slide this board up in a second. And what happens when you change it is the 6s go here and the 5s go here. Okay, so here's what happens in the tableau. So that's kind of weird, right? The numbers are moving in weird places and you actually look at it in terms of the tableau. If you think about it in terms of the abacus model and in terms of transpositions in the affine symmetric group, it's a little easier to see what's going on, but if you want to think about that crazy spin statistic, it turns out this is what you want to think about. So what Sarah, Billy, and I originally tried to do is, so Sarah realized that actually thinking of K-Schur functions in terms of this way is much easier than trying to figure out what's going on with the numbers in boxes. Right? Thinking about this in terms of intervals is like, well, the interval tells us how these numbers should change, because otherwise I would just not guess this. Right? And so we said, okay, well, what if we just do that, and we just do this interval exchange and hope for the best? Well, we hoped, and then it turns out, well, that doesn't quite work. So it's even more complicated than just figuring out that this is the right picture to think of. It turns out that what you're going to do is, so what is dual equivalence? So sometimes you have a chain. When you want to do dual equivalence, sometimes you can't even try to do it. So you end up with a chain, and the two types of chains where you kind of want to do dual equivalence, I'll draw examples. So there's this guy, and then let's do another example, which will be this guy. So here you could have sixes here and here, and fives here and here, and maybe you really want to do something where you change a six and a five, but this is actually giving you a chain. So there's no interval to exchange it with, but dual equivalence is telling me I need to do something. And the other thing, which is even more fun, is when you have a snake. So the terminology that I'm giving you now is just the terminology we use in our paper. So this is a block chain, and this is a snake chain. And again, n is equal to 4 for these examples. So sometimes you want to do some sort of switch, but what you have is actually a chain. If you drew it out in terms of that lattice, there's nothing to exchange it with. So the exchange, the obvious exchange to try, sometimes doesn't work, and sometimes you need to do something and you can't. So what Sarah and I figured out was that, well, the solution is instead of just looking at one interval, you're going to look at rank 3 intervals, and you're going to do a change here and a change there. And that turns out to be the solution. So if you want to know gory details of that, I'm happy to discuss them with you, but given the time constraints, there's no way I can even draw an example on the board. But we have tons of examples in our paper. So what is dual equivalence supposed to do? So I never actually told you what it means to be dual equivalence in general. I only told you Heyman's definition. So let me, in the last 10 minutes, tell you what a definition of dual equivalence in general is. So here's the definition. So there's a preprint on my website and on the archive now where I define dual equivalence, and I don't quite state it in the way that I'm stating it now, but there's another preprint coming soon where I will state it this way. I think this is an easier way to state it. So given this data, some set of objects and some function c from objects of these plus and minus 1s, right? So a family of involutions, volutions phi, here I is bigger than 1 and less than n. So you can think of phi in your head, you're thinking phi is what I just erased, where phi 2 switches the 2 and the 3 in this example. And then phi 3 would switch 3 and 2 or 3 and 4, depending. Okay? So it's these sort of elementary dual equivalences. That's what phi is, and it is an involution. So they're going to build up our dual equivalence. Okay, this guy is a dual equivalence model for the object in sigma if certain axioms hold. So let me tell you what the axioms are. Well, one, these guys are involutions, and what are the fixed points? So phi I of S is equal to S if and only if sort of the witness is I. So in the reading word, this means that 2 is in between 1 and 3. So, for example, I'll put an example here. 1, 2, 3, or 3, 2, 1, that'll be a fixed point. There is no dual equivalence that you can do in those examples. And those will be the only examples where you don't do anything. So when I said sometimes you get a chain and you want to do something, for example, right, if this 7 were starred and this 8 were starred and there were like a 6 lurking here that fell in between, so that you see, so if there were like a 6 here, it's possible this couldn't actually happen in this example, but this would look like 8, 6, 7, and it would say, okay, 7's not in the middle, so do something. This is the trouble that we get to with chains. You have to satisfy this axiom. There's another axiom which says that sigma j of phi I. So how do those, sigma j is just the jth coordinate. It says that basically I don't change anything other than these three at worst. So this is going to equal sigma j of s, if j is less than or equal to I minus 2, or j is greater than or equal to I plus 2. It's basically saying that what I'm doing is local. I'm not screwing around with numbers other than 1, 2, and 3. That's what this axiom says. It actually works in conjunction with this axiom, which says that phi j and phi I commute. So phi I, phi j of s, if the difference between I and j is at least 3. Right. So these two axioms together say that this dual equivalence is local. If I'm doing phi I, I only care about the numbers 1, 2, and 3. I'm not going to screw with anything else. Okay? And that's exactly what we're doing when we do these interval exchanges, because we limit where we're exchanging things. All the numbers below that and all the numbers above that stay the same. Okay, and then there's luckily I don't have much room, so that's my excuse for not telling you what this last one is. So there's a local commutivity axiom. For phi I minus 1, phi I, and phi I plus 1. So this tells you how things far apart relate, and this axiom tells you how things close together relate. So this is that's pretty much the definition of what it means to be a dual equivalence. You have to satisfy those axioms. And the only reason I'm not telling you this one is because it's just technical, and when you read it, it doesn't really help you understand the definition, in my opinion. You sort of have to play with it to really get a sense of it. But what this one essentially does is it establishes some sense of local sure positivity. And then together, all of these axioms give you global sure positivity, which is the theorem. So the theorem is that if phi is a dual equivalence model for some object and some function c, then for t some object fixed, the sum over everything in T's dual equivalence class. Right, so this is all the things you can get to by applying any phi i's for any I, right, to T, and doing it repeatedly. So just fill it out to a dual equivalence class. That's right. Q sigma of S, this thing is sure positive. And then additionally, so if stat is a function from objects, say, to the natural numbers, kind of like spin, some statistic that you have, and the statistic on phi I of s, basically phi I preserves your statistic, is equal to the statistic on s, then what you can do is move this guy over and throw in a t to the statistic. And it's still sure positive, because the t factors out. Yeah. Yeah, the first condition says that if you have plus plus or minus minus, you don't do anything. This is at position I minus 1, and this is at position I. So it says this is do nothing, and the opposite of do nothing is do something. So if you have plus minus or minus plus, then do something. Right, and again, this is position I minus 1, and this is position I in the signature. It's essentially what it says. Actually, that's exactly what it says. Right, so if you have a statistic and you care about that statistic, then what you need is that your dual equivalence model preserves that statistic, and then this t just factors out. I mean, adding the t in here is nothing special. It literally just factors out because it's constant on this entire equivalence class. Right? Okay, so then the theorem that Sarah Billy and I have is that this idea of doing interval exchanges in this somewhat complicated way of, like here, you sort of look at a whole rank 3 interval, and you do stuff there. Well, that will satisfy the first axiom because we force it to. That tells us when to do something. And it'll satisfy axioms, like the second and third axioms there are pretty easy to see. And the fourth axiom involved about a month on 8 computers to verify that. But since it's local, you can actually just check a bunch of cases, and a bunch happen to be a really large number, but manageable, even with my poor coding skills. So the theorem, which is due to the inferability, is that affine dual equivalence is a well-named thing. So it is a dual equivalence model for starred strong tableau and sigma. And miraculously, because we did not try to do this, this problem was hard enough without thinking about that spin statistic. So we said, well, even if we can get it without the spin statistic, then just set t equal to 1, and we have a nice theorem. And it turned out that all of our hard work, sort of either what we did is exactly the right thing to do, or the spin statistic is exactly the right statistic, or possibly both, but they work really well together. So somehow by a fluke of mathematics, and it preserves spin. So that statistic, this property actually holds. Therefore, so that's our theorem, and therefore we get that K-sure functions with this T statistic are equal to the sum of a bunch of sure functions, sum over lambda, and this guy is a polynomial in T with non-negative integer coefficients that we get just in terms of thinking of the affine dual equivalence classes. So you break everything up into affine dual equivalence classes, and now we get sure positivity from it. So that's the setup, and this really is what it comes down to, is looking at pictures like this. And I guess I'll say one more thing, that what's happening on the level of the reading word, right? Like I said before, on the level of the reading word, what we're doing is we're either doing dual equivalence, which says this, and it says this, or we're doing this. Which is sort of, if you thought about it for a few minutes without me talking, you would see that these are sort of the only two local things you can do that'll satisfy these axioms. Turns out for McDonald polynomials, you can do everything just on permutations, and these are the two things that you use on permutations. And that gets you McDonald positivity using the same machinery. It turns out that on the level of the reading word, which you can't go by just the reading word for K-sure functions, but if you just look at what happens on the reading word, it's exactly the same two things that are going on. So there is some nice connection. Like, somehow, these guys are really nicely related to McDonald polynomials. And in a lot of cases, if you look at sort of the structure of the dual equivalence class, and I like to think of dual equivalence class as actually the colored graph, and if you look at the structure of that graph, it's exactly the same. The McDonald graph actually breaks up into pieces that are the K-sure function graph, empirically. So that's not a theorem. If it were, we'd be even happier than we are. But it seems like that this approach of dual equivalence might give us a way to understand how McDonald polynomials and K-sure functions are related, which, given all the great geometry that's behind K-sure functions, for example, they show up in the quantum cohomology of the regular Grassmannian as the homology of the affine Grassmannian, and McDonald polynomials show up in terms of, like, isospectral Hilbert schemes. And so getting a connection there would be sort of interesting. It's not clear what that would be telling us about the geometry, if anything, but it certainly would be interesting. And we're hoping, so a continuing project that Sarah and I are doing is trying to push this through to get McDonald polynomials connected to K-sure functions in a more concrete way. So I think that was everything I wanted to cover. So thank you very much for your attention.